Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, child abuse in Oregon has increased dramatically since the state made deep cutbacks in its drug and alcohol treatment programs. It's the 25th anniversary of the first reported AIDS cases in the United States. The U.S. military admits more accidental deaths of civilians in Iraq. And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq,
as of today, there have been 2,476 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 42,646 civilians have been reported killed by the military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true body count may be as high as a quarter million. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 5th, 2006. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Marlise Franklin. The Supreme Court said today it will decide the extent to which public schools can use race in deciding school assignments, setting the stage for a landmark affirmative action ruling. Justices will hear appeals from a Seattle parents group and a Kentucky parent, ruling for the first time on diversity plans used by a host of school districts around the country. Race cases have been difficult for the justices. The court's announcement that will take up the cases this fall provides the first sign of an aggressiveness by the court under new Chief Justice John Roberts. The court rejected a similar case in December when moderate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was still on the bench. The outcome of this case will turn on her successor, Samuel Alito. Looming in the background of this is the constitutionality of affirmative action, said David Davison Douglas, a law professor at William & Mary. Quote, "This is huge," end quote. Arguments will likely take place in November. The court's announcement followed 6 weeks of internal deliberations over whether to hear the appeals, as an unusually long time.
Child abuse in Oregon has increased dramatically over the past 2 years, since the state made deep cutbacks in its drug, alcohol, and methamphetamine treatment programs. Officials say drug and alcohol abuse, which are the biggest factors in child abuse rates, have risen 25%. The latest annual report from the Oregon Department of Human Services showed that the agency received over 55,000 reports of suspected abuse or neglect in the fiscal year that ended September 30th. That's a 19% increase over the year before and a 125% increase over the previous decade. The state legislature cut funds for drug and alcohol treatment in 2003. Since then, the percentage of parents needing and getting alcohol and drug treatment in child welfare cases has dropped from 88% to 42%.
Boise Cascade Corporation supervisors instructed workers at its Umatilla plant to bypass safety mechanisms, concluded a state investigation into the death of an employee in December. The Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services Occupational Safety and Health Division issued a citation of three alleged safety violations and assessed a proposed civil penalty of $142,500. Gordon Cecil of Hermiston was killed last December while operating machines for converting waste wood into chips. A safety feature on a chip machine had been disabled by Boise Cascade, allowing the machine to eject a chunk of wood that hit Cecil in the back of the head. He was pronounced dead at the scene. After nearly 5 months of employee interviews, research, and review of the employer safety and health management program, Oregon OSHA found that safety protocols designed to protect workers from serious injury had been bypassed with the knowledge of supervisors.
The Illihi Institute's Oil and Water Speaker Series continues. My co-anchor, Marylise Franklin, attended this past weekend. Tonight she reports on what she learned about water rights in Oregon.
The Oil, Water, and Oregon Symposium was created as a forum to help businesses, policymakers, and citizens understand how oil and water issues will impact the Pacific Northwest and to find solutions for our shared energy and water future. A priori is the term that describes how water is allocated. It means first in time, first in rights. Bill Blosser, who chaired the state's Water Resources Commission, describes how, under this law, local fish and streams find themselves at the bottom of the barrel.
The unfortunate thing about water rights is that it's a system that's set up so that the first person who applied for the water gets the right to use it, as long as they keep using it. So if you look at streams in Oregon, virtually all of them, the first people who applied and got a right were agricultural users. And farther down the line, in terms of priority, would be some municipalities sometimes. And at the lowest priority is where you would get people who have applied for fish or wildlife purposes for preserving the water. It's only been 20, maybe the most 30 years that Oregon has even had a mechanism for creating a water right for fish and wildlife. So they tend to be what is called the lowest priority. So the fish kind of come out on the short end of the stick.
He further explained how these views are changing.
We have now changed our social priorities for what we think the water ought to be used for. And there's a higher value put on water for fish and wildlife and aesthetic purposes. Whereas in the old days, all the priority was on building an agricultural industry and industry and cities and so forth. And fish and wildlife were of virtually zero priority. When we built the dams, for example, in the Columbia River, they knew that that was going to wipe out the salmon. But that was such a low priority that nobody worried about it. And we built dams that wiped out salmon up in through the 1960s, knowing full well what it was going to do. So priorities have changed. And unfortunately, once you have that infrastructure in place, it's hard to change public policy to say, well, you got to remove your dam or whatever. So that's, to me, is the crux of the battle right now.
During the afternoon plenary session, Gail Achterman, the director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University, said that rather than wrestle with the current system of water rights, consumers and industry could be educated so they know exactly where they fall in line with their particular water right, whether it's a so-called junior or senior right. Gail Achterman.
Everybody talks about the prior appropriation system and how, you know, it's the icon of Western water law and you can't deviate from it at all. But when the going gets tough, the system goes out the window. And the senior water and the junior water right holders expect the state to compensate them before they get cut off. Nobody has any conception of what an 1898 right really is. You know, so if you buy a piece of property and you have an 1898 right, you might think, boy, that's great. That's a really old water right. And you have absolutely no conception of really how junior that water right is in the basin, and it'd take you a lot of work to find out how junior it is in the basin. So we would do, the department would do a hydrologic analysis of the basin. You take the historic hydrologic record, and then, based upon the historic hydrologic record, you would convert the seniority number into a percentage of time you were actually likely to get your water. And so that 1898 right, based upon the average water year in that particular basin, you know, if it's an 1898 right in the Grand Ronde, you'd probably have about a 0.2 water right. So if you bought your property and you knew you had a 0.2 instead of an 1898, it would send home the notion of what junior means in the system.
Achterman addresses the challenge of enforcing water rights by asking her panel colleague, Debbie Colbert, who is the Senior Policy Coordinator for the Oregon Water Resources Department, this question.
How many enforcement people do you have to make the prior appropriation system work in the state?
We have 20 water masters.
They have 20 water masters, and how many water rights do you have?
80,000
water rights. Now, they do not have their finger on the pulse there. And so people are stealing other people's water all the time, and nobody's doing anything about it. And nobody even knows that it's stealing because they just bought the water and they think they've got the right to take as much as they want anytime they want it.
In the case of water rights, it's a use-it-or-lose-it scenario. While few lose their water rights in this way, they are sold, leased, and even donated, for example, to local nonprofits whose purpose it is to enhance and protect streams and local fish habitat. Lastly, over 70% of urban water use in Oregon was not for drinking, or agriculture, or fish, or food, but for sprinkling the lawn. I'm Marlise Franklin, KBOO News. A group planning to develop tidal power projects has filed applications to study Deception Pass and the mouth of the Columbia River. The Washington, D.C.-based Climate Institute is also looking at other coastal sites around the nation where the power of water currents could generate electrical current. Founder John Topping says the turbines might look like underwater windmills. The group has asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for exclusive development rights. A consultant working on the permits, Charles Cooper of Lowell, Massachusetts, says studies will determine how the turbines would affect fish, boat traffic, and views. The company also applied for permits for 5 states in Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and New York. Andy?
Oregon wildlife officials are worried about their new comprehensive wildlife management plan, which was drawn up to prevent species from becoming endangered. The U.S. House of Representatives has proposed a major budget cut in the 5-year-old grants program. The House allocation of $50 million for the state wildlife grants is below the $74.7 million proposed in the president's budget. Holly Michael, the Conservation Strategy Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, says, "It really gives us a blueprint for the future. We're hoping that by showing the success, the Congress would come forward with more money in the future." Senator Ron Wyden is one of the 56 senators to sign a letter calling for the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee to provide $85 million for the program. According to the nonprofit Teaming with Wildlife, Oregon members of Congress, Senator Gordon Smith and U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer, Peter DeFazio, and Darlene Hooley also asked for $85 million. The Senate vote is expected by mid-June.
Governor Christina Gregoire could replace 5 members of the Washington State Pharmacy Board who said druggists should be able to refuse to dispense morning-after pills. The 5 members have not been confirmed, and Gregoire told the Seattle Times she needs a board that will focus on patient rights. The board voted last week to allow druggists to refuse to dispense morning-after pills if that violates their anti-abortion beliefs. Gregoire says moral grounds should not be a reason for a pharmacist to refuse service. The board will take a final vote in August. Gregoire says the 5 appointees have another chance to, quote, make it right.
25 years ago today, on June 5, 1981, the first 5 AIDS cases were reported. And 2.5 decades later, the disease has claimed more than 22 million lives worldwide, including more than 500,000 people in the United States. To mark the 25 years of AIDS research, the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, held a conference highlighting the history of AIDS, significant research breakthroughs, and the formidable challenges that lay ahead. Anastasia Genetskaya reports from Washington, D.C.
The most worrisome news about AIDS is that despite advancements in treatment, the overall number of HIV cases is increasing, 5 million new ones last year. Infection rates are falling in some heavily affected African countries. However, AIDS epidemic has stretched to the new regions of the world. Peter Pyatt, executive director, joined United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS.
The AIDS epidemic is not just one pandemic, it is many epidemics. And there is far bigger diversity today than there was ever before. The fastest growth is now in the countries of the former Soviet Union, driven by injecting drug use and driven by denial and stigma. We see a slow growth, but a very important growth because of the population denominator in China and in India. If 1% of Indian population is infected, that is 10 million people. That is more than the total population of many African countries.
The increase in the number of global HIV infections has to do with the rising global inequality fueled by globalization. Dr. Zerhuni, director of National Institutes of Health.
There is an increasingly disconnected component of the world. And if you look at how many people on Earth today are connected, have access, can, in fact, benefit from the research we do here at NIH, you come with a number of about 2 billion people. How many are disconnected? Over 3 billion people. And those 3 billion people represent as many humans as there were humans in 1950.
In the developed world, the development of AIDS medications, known as HIV inhibitors, gave hope to many people. A special documentary, America and AIDS, a 25-year perspective, produced by Stefan Hildebrand, features the case of AIDS patient John Lesnick.
I was just very lucky that I didn't get sick until the time that I did, and at that point, protease inhibitors were just around the corner.
And yet, when a leading AIDS activist, Larry Kramer, was asked by Robert Basil from NBC News about his opinion on scientific progress in treating HIV, his answer was,
"Where's the cure, you f***ers?" Where's the cure? Where's the vaccine? What are you doing down there, sitting on your hands?
Some scientists say the delay in developing a vaccine comes from the virus's remarkable variability. Other stumbling blocks to prevention are related to individual economic and social conditions. Victoria Cargill-Swiren, director of clinical studies and minority research at NIH, who for many years worked at a clinic in Anacostia.
While we may have over 20 drugs that are available to us, if you can't afford them, if you can't seek health care to obtain them, they're not useful to you. So that while we see the challenges in the developing world, I urge you to remember they happen here in our own domestic populations, many places where we have HIV infection rates that rival those areas. There are many factors that influence HIV infection in communities of color in particular: poverty, racism, the unequal access to health care, the fact that we have mistrust of our health care system.
8,000 people die of AIDS every day. UN officials estimate that $23 billion in funding is required each year to avert this situation. In 2005, the world spent only $8.3 billion. According to UNAIDS, the unwillingness of governments to commit substantial funds remains a formidable problem for the agency and their efforts. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditskaya in Washington, D.C.
The U.S. Department of Justice is monitoring tomorrow's primary election in 7 California counties to make sure officials serve voters who speak different languages. Alameda, Orange, San Benito, San Diego, San Mateo, Santa Clara, and Ventura counties are all required to provide election information, ballots, and voting assistance information in one or more minority languages under the 1965 Federal Anti-Discrimination Voting Rights Act. San Diego County, for instance, is required to provide voting materials in Spanish, Tagalog, and Vietnamese, along with poll workers who can translate those languages. Alameda County may see delays because it is using paper ballots after its touchscreen machines failed to meet federal and state standards.
South Dakota will also hold its state primary elections on Tuesday, and the American Civil Liberties Union will be watching polling sites to ensure that Native American voting rights are not compromised. FSRN's Jim Kent reports.
Black Moon versus the state and Quiver versus the state are just two of the many Native American voting rights lawsuits filed against South Dakota in recent years. ACLU spokesperson Jennifer Ring notes that even with appeals filed by the state in the many suits it's lost, some progress has been made.
The biggest case, of course, is the Boneshirt case that had to do with the legislative redistricting. The state has indicated it intends to appeal, but this election, there will be a single-member House district basically on the Rosebud Reservation, so that's one more seat for Native Americans.
Because of what Jennifer Ring calls South Dakota's long and ugly history of trying to exclude Native Americans from the political process, the ACLU will be closely monitoring the primary elections. Ring adds that reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, currently being debated in Congress, is critical to ensuring the voting rights of Native Americans in South Dakota and across the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Hot Springs, South Dakota.
A federal judge has thrown out a lawsuit challenging the state prison system's practice of putting two inmates in cells designed for one, saying the double bunking does not violate the U.S. Constitution. The lawsuit, first filed in 1995, claimed that the practice violated the ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Inmates at 13 maximum security prisons argued they were more likely to be assaulted, faced higher chances of catching a disease, and suffered harsh living conditions. The U.S. District Judge Gerald Lynch in a decision dated May 26 said that simply putting two convicts in a cell designed for one, quote, is a far cry from the wanton and unnecessary infliction of pain and against which the Eighth Amendment protects, end quote. Lynch says he used basic math, namely the Pythagorean theorem, to dispute arguments that those sharing cells were forced to sleep closer to the toilet than prisoners in single-person cells. Most of the cells have between 48 and 60 square feet of space.
Democrats blasted President Bush's proposed constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage as debate got underway on the Senate floor. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy said the Constitution is, quote, too important to use for such a partisan political purpose, end quote. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says with elections coming up and Republicans are down in the polls, they're turning to, quote, the same old playbook, fear and division, unquote. Meanwhile, alternative media from around the nation is playing and replaying audio recordings of First Lady Laura Bush telling Fox News on May 16th that gay marriage, quote, shouldn't be used as a campaign tool, obviously, unquote.
A divided Colorado Supreme Court is letting Denver's controversial ban on assault weapons and other gun control regulations stand. They're at odds with state law, but Denver had argued it had a right to pass its own gun laws as a home rule city with its own charter. Today's 3-3 vote means Denver can resume enforcing the ordinances, which were put on hold after the state passed laws in 2003 preempting most local firearms regulations. But because it was a tie vote, the Supreme Court did not provide an ultimate ruling on questions concerning whether a home rule city can issue ordinances superseding state law.
The Los Angeles Times is reporting that the Pentagon has decided to make it official to ignore key tenets of the Geneva Convention that explicitly banned humiliating and degrading treatment of detainees. According to the paper, the Pentagon's new Army Field Manual on interrogation marks a further and potentially permanent shift away from strict adherence to the international human rights standards. For decades, it's been the official policy of the U.S. military to follow the minimum standards for treating all detainees as laid out in the Geneva Convention. But in 2002, Bush suspended portions of the Geneva Convention for accused members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Critics said the Pentagon's latest decision could violate the broadly supported anti-torture measure advocated by Senator John McCain to ban torture and cruel treatment of prisoners. The Los Angeles Times reports that the move officially ignores parts of the Geneva Convention that was supported by President Dick Cheney's office and by the Pentagon's intelligence arm. Sources said Cheney's Chief of Staff David Addington and Stephen Cambone, a Defense Undersecretary for Intelligence, claimed the Geneva Conventions restricted the United States' ability to question detainees.
The Board of Governors of the American Bar Association voted unanimously Saturday to investigate whether President Bush has exceeded his constitutional authority in reserving the right to ignore more than 750 laws that have been enacted since he took office. Meeting in New Orleans, the Board of Governors for the world's largest association of legal professionals approved the creation of an all-star legal panel with a number of members from both political parties. Among the laws Bush has challenged are the ban on torturing detainees, oversight provisions in the USA Patriot Act, and whistleblower protections for federal employees. The challenges also have included safeguards against political interference in taxpayer-funded research. Bush has challenged more laws than all previous presidents combined.
Corruption prosecutions against former Bush administration officials continued in the case of imprisoned Republican Jack Abramoff. Former Bush administration official David Safavian acknowledged in court today that he gave advice and some non-public information about federal properties to Abramoff, now serving 5 to 10 years in prison for defrauding Native tribes and buying off U.S. government officials. But Safavian denied trying to conceal that from the government investigators, as the defense concluded its case after a second day of cross-examination in the U.S. District Court. Safavian, a former chief federal procurement officer in the Bush White House, is charged with concealing the fact that he aided Abramoff on GSA properties and that the disgraced lobbyist wanted to buy, lease, or redevelop.
The personal data of as many as 50,000 active Navy and National Guard personnel were among those stolen from a Department of Veterans Affairs employee last month, the government said Saturday in a disclosure that goes beyond what the administration had initially reported. The VA previously said the stolen data involved as many as 26.5 million veterans discharged since 1975, as well as some of their spouses. Veterans discharged before 1975 are also deemed at risk if they have submitted benefit claims to the agency. Veterans groups have criticized the administration for the three-week delay in publicizing the burglary after the May 3rd theft. Last week, internal documents obtained by the Associated Press showed that the stolen data in many cases included the phone numbers and addresses of veterans, as well as 6,744 records pertaining to mustard gas veterans, or those who participated in chemical testing programs during World War II.
The U.S. military announced today that it accidentally killed three Iraqi civilians near homes during a training exercise last week. According to the Pentagon, Task Force Band of Brothers unit fired a 155-millimeter round from a self-propelled howitzer on a military base near Baqaba that landed in a village miles away. The military admits an explosion from the howitzer fire destroyed a building in the town and killed three Iraqi civilians, injured three others, and damaged six houses. The announcement comes after the military's admission that the U.S. Marines killed 24 civilians, including a 66-year-old woman and a 4-year-old boy, in the western town of Haditha last November. In our continuing coverage of the massacre, FSRN's correspondents Aaron Glantz and Sam Tlaib took a look at the culture of the U.S. military occupation in Iraq and why it leaves so many Iraqi civilians dead.
Joseph Hatcher served in the western Iraqi town of Dor from February 2004 until March last year. He told Free Speech Radio News his cultural training before deployment consisted of 1 3-hour class and a pamphlet.
It's just like, here's where you are on a map, because you'd be surprised how many people don't know that. And it just kind of works down from there. Like, these are poisonous animals. Keep away from them. This is how you say, like, I mean, the only language training we received was like a handout flipbook type flyer, which, you know, is stuff like, get on your hands and knees, don't resist, you know, where are the weapons, stuff like that. It's not calm social interaction type stuff.
Did you practice how to say those phrases?
I did not, no. Very few people did.
During his time in Iraq, Hatcher took part in many house-to-house raids, like the one in Haditha, which left 24 Iraqi civilians dead. He said none of the members of his unit spoke Arabic, and usually they went in without a translator.
We use very little language at all during house raids. I mean, you go in with a barrel pointed at somebody and you pull them to the ground. It's fairly standard. There's no way of knowing if you're getting anyone who's worth anything. I mean, you'll go in and you'll indiscriminately raid an entire block of homes.
Salam al-Amidi worked as translator for the U.S. military in the northern city of Mosul, which has been controlled by insurgents for over a year. He notes the U.S. military relies mostly on paid informants in deciding which houses to raid.
We depend on some sources. We call the sources. A person come to us and say, hey, I got some information. We depend on that person. So that person, maybe he wanted revenge on that family. He just came to us and said, I've seen that dude selling weapons to somebody else. We just go to that house at like 3 o'clock, 12 o'clock in the morning. We just broke the door. We just break the door and break everything. You know, the house, we just arrest that dude in a very bad way. Not in a good way, actually. That's a matter of fact, you know. We pulled him on the ground.
Oftentimes, the raids end badly. This morning, the Washington Post reported on a raid that took place in April. According to the Post, Marines went to the home of a 52-year-old disabled Iraqi, took him outside, and shot him 4 times in the face. Like the killings in Haditha, the Marines involved are being investigated, and all 8 have been removed from Iraq and are being held at Camp Pendleton in California. Increasingly, though, politicians are arguing military justice is not enough. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island spoke on Fox News Sunday.
The test will be whether the leadership in the Department of Defense and in the administration does not try to confine these incidents in small sort of compartments and say it was just a few Marines or a few soldiers, but looks to see if this is part of a larger systemic problem.
But the Pentagon seems to be moving in the opposite direction. The LA Times reports today the Defense Department has decided to omit from the new detainee policies a key tenet of the Geneva Convention that explicitly bans humiliating and degrading treatment. According to knowledgeable military officials, that's a step that would mark a further, potentially permanent shift away from strict adherence to international human rights standards. At this point, Iraq war veteran Joseph Hatcher doubts any policy shift would make a difference.
We have undertrained, under-equipped, ignorant troops wandering around that country, indiscriminately kicking in doors, and no amount of cultural training or proper interpreters is going to keep us from looking like the bad guy to the Iraqi people.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
And now commentary by Seattle Weekly columnist Jav Parrish.
Undermining the war effort. This is Jav Parrish. Reports of the alleged execution of up to 24 Iraqi civilians by U.S. Marines in the city of Haditha last November have been floating around since February. Until recently, Haditha generated a disinterested murmur, barely louder than that of all the other reports of U.S. killings of numbers of Iraqi civilians that have surfaced in the last 3 years. But a Time magazine report and a subsequent U.S. military investigation have suddenly turned Haditha into a major story. And so it was that Pentagon ally and war critic Representative Jack Murtha made headlines last Sunday when he pronounced that Haditha might be, quote, worse than Abu Ghraib for its potential to undermine the U.S. war effort. Let's set aside for a moment the most obvious response to Murtha's concern. How can you undermine a complete disaster? Murtha's reasoning bugs me a lot, both for what it says about the American public's idea of war and for a rather patronizing idea of Iraqis. Every poll shows that a supermajority of the Iraqi public would like to see at least a timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal, if not an immediate pullout. But somehow Murtha, and for Representative Murtha, you may insert the thinking of most anyone among the Beltway political class, somehow Murtha is concerned that Haditha will sour the opinions of Iraqis already largely opposed to our presence. But to suggest that the commission of an atrocity will all but doom the war effort is to suggest that the war effort was, from its inception, all but doomed. Atrocities happen in every war. It's the nature of war. Counterinsurgency wars are especially nasty. One should expect bad things to happen when one makes a decision to go to war. If Haditha means that the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq in the future is unlikely to be productive, then what it means is that there was never any chance that our soldiers' presence would be productive in the first place, because atrocities were all but inevitable. Which, I suspect, is not what Representative Murtha was trying to say, although it may well be true. And in terms of worse than Abu Ghraib, I get kind of fuzzy as to why the moral fallout from the actions of a dozen mostly low-ranking Marines will be worse than that of torture policies that killed dozens crafted and approved at the highest levels of U.S. government. I'm also having a hard time understanding why the average Iraqi should care about the cold-blooded murders of a couple dozen more civilians when somewhere between 40,000 and 200,000 civilians have already died as a result of this war, and another 500,000 civilians died as a result of the economic sanctions that preceded it. What's the difference between the cold-blooded executions, if that's what happened in Haditha, and soldiers that proceed despite the statistical certainty of massive collateral damage? The oops, we weren't really aiming for them in defense, might make our soldiers and a queasy American public feel better about civilian deaths we've caused halfway around the world, but to survivors, loved ones, and the Iraqi countrymen who will be the ultimate judges of whether U.S. soldiers' success has been undermined, I doubt that it makes much difference at all. Dead is dead. If it's at the hands of a foreign occupier, how inclined would you be to either take an uninvestigated claim of that was an accident at face value, or to forgive the perpetrators? The cover-up of Haditha is even less of a shock than the original atrocity. From Abu Ghraib to White Phosphorus to Pat Tillman and Jessica Lynch, virtually every major story in the last 3 years involving the battlefield has involved either fanciful storytelling or serious butt-covering by the Pentagon. The tone starts with George W. Bush and oozes its way down the chain of command. Have Iraqis caught on to the fact that official America lies routinely? Sure they have. It's patronizing and insulting to think otherwise. Should Iraqis be angry, and will they be angry, about what happened in Haditha? Of course. But I very much doubt that they're surprised, and we shouldn't be either. This is what war smells like. Iraqis know that all too well. The sooner Americans figure it out, the better. KBOO, this is Jav Parrish.
It was bad enough that his son died in Iraq, but when anti-gay protesters turned up at a young Marine's funeral, a father was pushed too far. So Albert Snyder is filing a lawsuit against a fundamentalist Kansas church whose members picketed the service in Maryland. Snyder is seeking unspecified damage from the Westboro Baptist Church of Topeka. Its members routinely demonstrate at military funerals, contending that those deaths are God's punishment for America's tolerance of gays. Several states have responded with laws banning funeral protests, but the church says it's the first time that a military family has sued them. But they plan a countersuit. Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder died on March 3rd in an accident in Iraq.
Police said today more arrests are likely in an alleged plot to bomb buildings in Canada, while intelligence officers sought ties between the 17 suspects and Islamic terror cells in the United States and five other nations. A court said authorities had charged all 12 adults arrested over the weekend with participating in a terrorist group. Others' charges included importing weapons and planning a bombing. The charges against five minors were not made public. The Parliament of Canada, located in Ottawa, was believed to be one of the targets the group discussed. Authorities said more arrests were expected possibly this week as police pursue leads about a group they say was inspired by the violent ideology of the Al-Qaeda terror network.
The current time is 5:36:41. And now time for another commentary from Jim Hightower.
Did you see that picture of George W. riding around in circles in a decked-out red, white, and blue dune buggy down on the Mexican border? Apparently, he was trying to look like a tough guy border defender, protecting us from illegal immigrants. Instead, he looked like some goofy cartoon character out of the Flintstones. It was perfect symbolism, though, for the Republican leadership has been running around in circles on the immigration issue, clownishly trying to juggle their right-wing lock-em-out anti-immigrant absolutism, while also trying to dance the two-step with their big business backers, who happen to profit from the cheap labor of destitute Latino laborers. So, on the one hand, these clowns want to militarize the Mexican border, including erecting a monstrous three-tiered fence to keep Mexicans out. But on the other hand, they want a Bracero-style program to keep the cheap labor flowing into our economy. Then, just when you thought their political posturing couldn't get any goofier than putting Bush in a dune buggy, they came up with a truly silly act of hyperactive xenophobia. They passed a resolution declaring that English is the national language of the USA. Wow, that'll show those immigrants. Not since the House decreed in 2003 that French fries should be renamed Freedom Fries has our Congress demonstrated such ludicrous loopiness and embarrassing ineptness. Their Speak English bill is a hoot, for it requires more thorough testing to prove English language proficiency. Yet, the very goofballs pushing this wouldn't know proper English if it smacked them in the mouth. Have you ever heard George W. talk? This is the mumble mouth who routinely says things like, "Rarely is the question asked, is our children learning?" This is Jim Hightower saying, forget remembering the Alamo. With this new law, our Texas war cry will have to be, "Remember the Cottonwood." Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast, and then at 6 o'clock here, Labor Radio. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. The weather. Tomorrow in the Willamette Valley will be mostly cloudy in the morning and then some sun later on, high in the low 70s. In the Columbia Gorge, higher in the 80s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The first U.S. National Guard troops have reached the border. 55 members of the Utah National Guard have arrived at the Arizona border with Mexico to perform support duties such as building roads and installing lights. Free Speech Radio News' Patrick Engstrom-Poor reports from Tucson.
On Sunday, Arizona's Migrant Human Rights Coalition No More Deaths completed a 75-mile walk from the Mexican border to Tucson, raising awareness about the deadly circumstances for border crossers in the Sonora Desert. At least 79 migrants have died so far this year, and triple-digit temperatures have only just begun. On Saturday, 55 members of the Utah National Guard arrived in Arizona to perform support duties, such as building roads and installing lights. Joseph Nevins, an expert on border policy at Vassar College, participated in the walk and gave his reaction.
By increasing the number of people policing the boundary, it's going to force people into harsher terrain, force them to take longer journeys, and you know the result is obvious. It's going to be increased human suffering, and we have to, for that reason, we have to oppose it.
The Utah Guard joins about 150 National Guard troops already in place, with an expected 300 Arizona Guard to join them in June. President Bush plans to send up to 6,000 troops to four border states as part of a program to increase policing of the southern border. For FSRN, I'm Patrick Engstrom-Poor in Tucson.
Mexico is creating an environmental reserve about 30 feet wide and 600 miles long on the Texas border, a, quote, green wall to protect the Rio Grande from the roads and staging areas that smugglers use to ferry drugs and migrants across the frontier. The proposed Rio Bravo del Norte Natural Monument is only about 30 feet wide. It will connect two large protected areas south of the river. When a third nature reserve known as Ocampo is created this year, the protected areas in Mexico will form a wall of millions of acres of wilderness matching Texas's Big Bend parks foot by foot along the border. Big Bend National Park has had some problems with migrant and drug trafficking, but Superintendent John King says extending the protected areas on either side of the border will likely keep the destruction from getting worse. He said, quote, when you have a roadless area, you make it more difficult for these activities to happen, end quote.
Chilean high school students have called for a nationwide general strike today. They're hoping to pressure the government to include the right to an education in the Constitution. Jorge Garaton reports from Santiago.
The national work stoppage day has been successful, as students have organized a series of peaceful actions throughout the country. University students have temporarily suspended classes in support of the high school students. But in downtown Santiago, there have been running battles between police and stone-throwing students and hooded youths. President Michelle Bachelet regretted the action, saying that the government has answered most of their demands. She says her government will create a commission that includes students that will reform the Education Act to ensure that education is a constitutionally protected right instead of a for-profit enterprise. As the government responds to the students' demands has received widespread approval from the public, the students will have to tread in careful waters to ensure their gains are not lost with pressure tactics that continue without an end in sight. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Peru's former president, Alan Garcia, won the final round of presidential elections in Peru yesterday. Diletta Valese reports from Peru, where Garcia, the moderate of two candidates, will have to face a large opposition presence in Congress.
In Peru, hope triumphed over fear, the capacity of going forward to create triumph over disorder. I believe it is fundamental for our country to be the first economic power on the Pacific coast and exceed all our neighbor countries.
With those words from a victory speech delivered last night, Alan Garcia called the development of Peru as the strongest South American state on the Pacific coast. He also promised to increase external economic investments and create more jobs. Garcia, running for the APRA party, which stands for America Popular Revolutionary Alliance, has already been president of Peru from 1985 to 1990. His previous government is remembered for having raised inflation by 7,000% and for having strongly repressed the guerrilla movement of Sendero Luminoso, which cost hundreds of lives of innocent farmers in Ayacucho region. Political analysts say Alan Garcia won mostly due to Peruvian voters' opposition to Venezuela President Hugo Chavez. Chavez has openly spoken against Garcia and his previous administration. Lisa Guzman, a Garcia supporter, put it this way.
We want Chavez out. We can think on our own.
We don't want anybody to order us around. We're the democracy, so down with Chavez and Ollanta.
After Ollanta Humala conceded defeat last night, he called on the Peruvian people to unite and to keep working on raising the political consciousness of the public under the values on the nationalist policy he had proposed.
We'll work to make our project reality. That's why we're the first majority in the Congress and we're the majority in the regions. I believe that, on a national level, this is a triumph for democracy and of the Peruvian people. I greet all the nationalist families who believe in the nationalism project, because tonight is a night of victory. We managed in such a short time to awaken the public conscience.
By 4 p.m. Sunday, the electoral polls closed and a private survey agency responsible for counting votes immediately declared Garcia the new president of Peru with 55% of votes over 45% for Ollanta Humala. At 9:15 p.m. local time, Peru's National Office of Electoral Process, or OMPE, declared that 77.3% of polls had confirmed Alan Garcia's victory. Next Monday in Quito, Ecuador, a meeting of all Andean region presidents will take place, including Venezuela President Hugo Chavez, who announced a week ago that he has no intention of cooperating with an administration headed by Alan Garcia. For First Pitch Radio News, Diletta Varlese in Lima, Peru.
Eight Western oil workers kidnapped in Nigeria's Niger Delta region have been released. The kidnapping was the latest carried out by local youths protesting the activities of Western oil companies. And there are fears that the unending crisis will affect the international oil market. For Free Speech Radio News, Sam Olukaya reports from Lagos.
In recent months, several oil workers have been kidnapped in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. The local youths carrying out the kidnappings are mainly targeting Westerners working for Western oil companies. More than four decades of oil exploitation in the region have benefited Western oil companies at the expense of local people. Local communities are suffering frequent oil pollution, which affects the lands and rivers from which they make a living. Mike Karikbo of the advocacy group Environmental Rights Action says this is why the communities are angry with the companies, which include Shell, Chevron and ExxonMobil.
Communities feel that they are not relevant in the scheme of things. They are not part and parcel of the development going on around them. And they are bearing the brunt of this particular development.
Anyakwe Nsimirovo, a campaigner for the rights of local people, believes the spate of kidnappings will continue because Western oil companies are reluctant to respond to the grievances of the communities.
The violence and conflict in the Niger Delta is most likely to continue if the fundamental issues are not dealt with. The fundamental issue, oil is one, degradation of environment is one. So whether you like it or not, you know, unless those fundamental issues are dealt with, this violence is going to continue. Kidnapping, making the whole environment unconducive for business and even for living.
A rather hostile operating environment has affected oil exploitation in the Niger Delta. Che Ibebura, who says people in his village are suffering respiratory ailments as a result of gas flaring by oil companies, says given the degree of environmental problems in the Niger Delta, communities have nothing to lose if oil exploitation stops in the region.
It will only hurt the industrialists, those whose aim is just to maximize profit. What are we gaining from the extraction of oil? We are not gaining, we are losing our lands. You know, there are a lot of diseases now that has never been known to the community, the people. So what are we gaining? Than sorrow.
Following the crisis in the Niger Delta, where all of Nigeria's oil comes from, most drops in oil production have led to an increase in oil prices in the international oil market. Nigeria is the world's sixth largest oil exporter. The country also accounts for the bulk of the oil in the Gulf of Guinea, where the United States is turning to following threats to its oil imports from the Middle East. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The ongoing problem of violence and abuse in Australia's indigenous communities has led to calls for tougher sentencing. The country's federal government now wants to abolish the rights of indigenous offenders to use their cultural customs or the notion of customary law as a defense. Elise Potaka reports from Sydney.
Aboriginal communities in Australia's Northern Territory have been at the center of intense political debate after reports of endemic violence against women and children recently emerged in the media. Now, Federal Indigenous Affairs Minister Mal Brough is talking tough on law and order. He says Indigenous offenders who perpetrate violent crimes shouldn't be able to cite cultural factors or what's known as customary law as a defence.
You don't allow, not just Indigenous people, not Australian Indigenous people, but any group to use what they would claim to be a culturally sensitive or culturally traditional practices which involve serious crime, serious pain to other people. They will not be able to use that as a defence.
The customary law defence allows judges to look at a range of potentially mitigating factors, including a person's cultural upbringing and beliefs, when handing down a sentence. The Indigenous Affairs Minister says the defence is being abused, but Sharon Payne, the Director of the Northern Territory's Aboriginal Legal Service, says Minister Brough is exaggerating the extent to which this kind of defence is accepted by judges.
Just because somebody says, oh, it's Aboriginal custom, the court just doesn't accept that. They go, and certainly if it's so extreme, that is, you know, the rape of a child, then they will certainly get another opinion, and often it's from the women in the community, the law women, who say, no, that's not right, that's not how it's done.
The customary law defence also allows judges to consider the fact that an Indigenous offender might be subject to punishment by their own community. Australian law includes the notion of double jeopardy, that is, you can't be tried for the same crime twice. Larissa Berendt is a Professor of Law and Indigenous Studies at the University of Technology, Sydney.
There certainly has been instances where judges have taken into account the fact that the behaviour of the defendant can lead to payback in a community to give a lessened sentence, because they have thought that if they did sentence them, then the offender would be punished twice.
Sharon Payne says that there have been cases in the Northern Territory where the idea of payback has resulted in a lesser sentence by the courts.
The person was bailed back to their community at Lajamanu, where they received a spearing in the leg, and the judge knew that that, you know, could be a possibility. And so when the the sentence then reflected the fact that he had already been punished for his crime.
For lawyers like Larissa Berendt, it doesn't make sense. She says regardless of heritage, cultural factors are always taken into consideration by judges.
It's a very slippery slope if we start to tie the ability of judges to be able to take into account all of those factors, or you are going to actually end up with a system that won't allow you to be flexible enough to deal out justice in each case.
Larissa Berendt also believes that the government's tough talk on law and order is just obscuring the real solution to issues faced by the communities in the Northern Territory. Only weeks ago, the federal government recorded a massive budget surplus. Larissa Berendt wants some of this money to be spent on providing services to Aboriginal communities. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Elise Portaka in Sydney.
An Islamic militia with alleged ties to Al-Qaeda seized Somalia's capital today after weeks of fighting with U.S.-backed warlords. The advance unified the city for the first time in more than a decade and after 15 years of anarchy in the Horn of Africa nation. But it's also posed a direct challenge to the fledging U.N.-backed Somali government. The deeply religious militia, which formed an alliance that transcends clan, controls a 65-mile radius around the capital after fighting off a secular alliance of warlords. The Islamic militia is gaining ground just as the UN-backed interim government struggles to assert control outside its base in Baidoa, 155 miles from Mogadishu. Prices for weapons soared there Monday as fears grew the militia could head to Baidoa next.
That is the KABU Evening News for, what are we looking at, Monday, June 5th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kbu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer is Joshonya Watson. Tonight's audio editors are Jacob Fenstein and Josonia Watson. Special thanks to Marlies Franklin, and our engineer is Jonathan Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Marlies.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News at 5:55. And at 6, it is Labor Radio. At 7 o'clock tonight over at the First Unitarian, Greg Pallast is in town. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 a.m. is the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, in between the covers, head host Ed Goldberg speaks with Elizabeth Rosner, author of Blue Nude, the story of an artist and his model and the moral and political implications of their relationship. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with a focus on books by black authors. At 10, Ariel Gore interviews Dexter Flowers about her Spoken Mic, which is emerging as the hot queer and queer-friendly spoken word review in town, and her latest zine release party for the show Under the Sea. And at 10:30, on stage and studio, topics include our DeMaio's new show Yarn and Artist Repertory Theater's production of The Theater District. And of course, at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us. And one last thing, are you passionate about the news? Do you like to read and write? Are you available for at least one weekday per week? The KBOO Evening News needs wire editors and audio editor trainees, people who dream of becoming citizen reporters. This is you. Call Lisa Loving at 503-231-8032, extension 203. I sign up for a shift on the KBOO Evening News. It's easy. Even I could do it.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 5th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In northeast Wisconsin, the Mole Lake Sakag and Chippewa are celebrating the end of a 30-year battle over metallic sulfide mining between the tribe and one of the world's largest mining companies. As Nick Vanderpie of the Superior Broadcast Network reports, last Friday, Australian-based BHP Billiton exchanged gifts with the tribe and agreed to leave the minerals underground.
Sandy Rochelle is the Mole Lake Sakag and Chippewa chairwoman. She says the tribe doesn't plan to mine the several billion-dollar mineral deposit.
Why is it important for our community to get that land? Is to keep it, preserve it, and take care of it. And that's our goal. That was always our goal, to protect that land and protect our water.
For their part, BHP Billiton, as a gesture of goodwill, gave back the tribe's $8 million final mortgage payment as an endowment for the tribe. Gibson Pierce, BHP Billiton manager for closed mines, explains.
We believe that we can now exit this project knowing that we've left a plan in place that will offer sustainable development to the community in the Crandon project area.
And for his part, a warrior for the Mole Lake Sakag and Chippewa, Tony Randall, feels some gratitude.
I'm surprised that they found something, some kind of light or hope or something to help us out the way they have. Because really, we were in a rock and a hard place. And without their help and what they've done for us today, how do you thank them for that?
The tribe wants to build a youth center and revitalize the language. I'm Nick Vanderpie on the Mole Lake Reserve.
A Northwest tribe is uneasy about a landmark agreement that's designed to settle a cross-border pollution dispute. The agreement is between the EPA and Canadian mining giant Teck Cominco. For decades, the company dumped toxic smelter waste into the Columbia, just north of the border. The river carried the pollution into the U.S. and into the heart of Coville tribal lands in Washington State. Now Teck has agreed to pay for an extensive contamination study. But tribal official D.R. Michelle is wary.
Well, we're not a party to the agreement. It's a private contract between
EPA and Tech Cominco were kind of on the outside looking in.
2 years ago, the Colville filed suit to force Tech Cominco to clean up the heavy metals in Lake Roosevelt. The matter is still pending in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Officials on both sides say it's too soon to know how this agreement will affect the case. Meanwhile, five First Nation communities on the west coast of Vancouver Island have renewed an agreement with the British Columbia government. Craig McCulloch has details.
The renewed agreement sees $600,000 provided to the Central Region Chiefs Administration and the Central Region Board. The organization overlooks development plans, applications, permits, and the minutiae of the area's natural resources. Sean Atleo is both a hereditary chief of the Ahusat, a member of the Nechanoth, and the regional chief of the BC Assembly of First Nations. He is hoping this agreement and others like it will eventually allow for proper treaties between First Nations like his and different levels of government.
Well, quite clearly, the most fundamental underlying issue that we face in our relationship between First Nations and the levels of government is that all levels of government have still in place policies of extinguishment of title and rights, denial of title and rights. We're really, you know, still doing our very best to stay in the negotiating rooms and having discussions in boardrooms, and we want to get out of the courts. There's over 100 cases in British Columbia right now, of which just over 40 are civil and have to do with title and rights. That's what would allow me to have a sense of hope that an agreement like this one for the central region of Nechanoth and the west coast of Vancouver Island will be lasting for future generations.
Chief Atleo also believes that major legislative changes have to be made in order for agreements to be found on most land claim treaties. I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
This is Independent Native News with help from Elizabeth Wynn Johnson in Coeur d'Alene. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
He's America's most censored journalist. He uncovered how George Bush stole the election in 2000 and again in 2004. Now he's ready to show you the whole armed madhouse, from stolen ballot boxes to the war on terror as profit center. KBOO 90.7 FM and the Portland Alliance brings you Greg Palast on Monday, June 5th at First Unitarian Universalist Church at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. Admission $8 to $15. Program begins at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. Hosted by Dave Mazza and includes special guest Air America's Tom Hartman. Don't miss Greg's reading from his new book, Armed Madhouse, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. Copies on sale and signed at the program. For more information, call 503-239-4991.